asked for this, begged the wise men for this. Her proximity to them had made it possible. And so May was not as close as she'd imagined. Annie still held some particular status. Again, Annie's lineage, her head start, the varied and ancient advantages she enjoyed, were keeping May second. Always second, like she was some kind of little sister who never had a chance of succeeding an older, always older sibling. May was trying to remain calm, but messages were coming through her wrist that made clear her viewers were seeing her frustration, her distraction. She needed to breathe. She needed to think. But there was too much in her head. There was Annie's ludicrous gamesmanship. There was this ridiculous past-perfect thing which should have gone to May. Was it because May's parents had slipped off the path? And where were her parents anyway? Why were they sabotaging everything May was working for? But what was she working for anyway, if 368 circlers didn't approve of her, 368 people who apparently actively hated her enough to push a button at her, to send their loathing directly to her, knowing she would know immediately their sentiments? And what about this cellular mutation some Scottish scientist was worried about, a cancerous mutation that might be happening inside May, provoked by mistakes in her diet? Had that really happened? And shit, May thought, her throat tightening. Did she really send a frown to a group of heavily armed paramilitaries in Guatemala? What if they had contacts here? Certainly, there were plenty of Guatemalans in California, and certainly they would be more than happy to have a trophy like May to punish her for her opprobrium. Fuck, she thought. Fuck. There was a pain in her, a pain that was spreading its black wings inside her, and it was coming primarily from the 368 people who apparently hated her so much they wanted her gone. It was one thing to send a frown to Central America, but to send one just across campus? Who would do that? Why was there so much animosity in the world? And then it occurred to her, in a brief and blasphemous flash, she didn't want to know how they felt. The flash opened up into something larger, an even more blasphemous notion that her brain contained too much, that the volume of information, of data, of judgments, of measurements was too much, and there were too many people, and too many desires of too many people, and too many opinions of too many people, and too much pain from too many people, and having all of it constantly collated, collected, added, and aggregated, and presented to her as if that all made it tidier and more manageable. It was too much. But no. No, it was not, her better brain corrected. No, you're hurt by these 368 people. This was the truth. She was hurt by them, by the 368 votes to kill her. Every one of them preferred her dead. If only she didn't know about this. If only she could return to life before this 3%, when she could walk through campus, waving, smiling, chatting idly, eating, sharing human contact, without knowing what was deep in the hearts of the 3%. To frown at her, to stick their fingers at that button, to shoot her that way? It was a kind of murder. May's wrist was flashing with dozens of messages of concern. With help from the campus sea change cameras, watchers were noticing her standing, stock still, her face contorted into some raging, wretched mask. She needed to do something. She went back to CE, waved to Jarrett and the rest, and logged herself into the chute. In minutes, she had helped with a query from a small jewelry maker in Prague, had checked out the maker's website, had found the work intriguing and wonderful, and had said so, aloud and in a zing, which produced an astronomical conversion rate and a retail raw, in 10 minutes, of 52,098 euros. She helped a sustainably sourced furniture wholesaler in North Carolina, Design for Life, and after answering their query, they wanted her to fill out a customer survey, which was especially important given her age and income bracket. They needed more information about the preferences of customers in her demographic. She did that, and also commented on a series of photos her contact at Design for Life, Sherry Lee Franteau, had sent her of her son at his first t-ball practice. When May commented on those photos, she received a message from Sherry Lee thanking May and insisting that she come to Chapel Hill sometime to see Tyler in person and eat some genuine barbecue. May agreed she would, feeling very good to have this new friend on the opposite coast, and moved on to her second message from a client, Jerry Ulrich, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, who ran a refrigerated truck company. He wanted May to forward a message to everyone on her list about the company's services, that they were trying very hard to increase their presence in California, and any help would be appreciated. May zinged him that she would tell everyone she knew, starting with the 14,611,002 followers she had, and he sent word back that he was thrilled to have been so introduced, and that he welcomed business or comments from all 14,611,002 people. 1,556 of whom instantly greeted Jerry and said they, too, would spread the word. Then, as he was enjoying the flood of messages, he asked May how his niece, who was graduating from Eastern Michigan University in the spring, might go about getting a job at the Circle. It was her dream to work there, and should she move out to the West to be closer, or should she hope to get an interview based on her resume alone? May directed him to the HR department and gave him some hints of her own. She added the niece to her contact list and made a note to keep track of her progress if she indeed applied for work there. One customer, Hector Casilla of Orlando, Florida, told May about his interest in birding, sent her some of his photos, which May praised and added to her own photo cloud. Hector asked her to rate them, for this might get him noticed in the photo-sharing group he was trying to join. She did so, and he was ecstatic. Within minutes, Hector said, someone in his photo-sharing group had been deeply impressed that an actual circler was aware of his work, so Hector thanked May again. He sent her an invitation to a group exhibition he was part of that winter in Miami Beach, and May said if she found herself down that way in January, she would certainly attend, and Hector, perhaps misconstruing the level of her interest, connected her with his cousin, Natalia, who owned a bed and breakfast only 40 minutes from Miami, and who could absolutely get May a deal if she chose to come out. Her friends, too, were welcome. Natalia then sent a message with the B&B's rates, which, she noted, were flexible if she wanted to stay during the week. Natalia followed up a moment later with a long message full of links to articles and images of the Miami area, elucidating the many activities possible in winter. Sport fishing, jet skiing, dancing. May worked on, feeling the familiar tear, the growing blackness, but working through it, killing it, until she finally noticed the time. 10:32. She'd been in CE for over 4 hours. She walked to the dorms, feeling far better, feeling calm, and found Francis in bed, working on his tablet, pasting his face into his favorite movies.
"Check this out," he said,
and showed her a sequence from an action movie where, instead of Bruce Willis, the protagonist now seemed to be Francis Garaventa. The software was near perfect, Francis said, and could be operated by any child. The Circle had just purchased it from a 3-person startup out of Copenhagen.
"I guess you'll see more new stuff tomorrow," Francis said,
and May remembered the meeting with the plankton pitchers.
"It'll be fun. Sometimes the ideas are even good, and speaking of good ideas..."
And then Francis pulled her down to him and kissed her and pulled her hips into him, and for a moment she thought they were about to have something like a real sexual experience, but just when she was taking off her shirt, she saw Francis clench his eyes and jerk forward, and she knew he was already done. After changing and brushing his teeth, he asked May to rate him, and she gave him 100. May opened her eyes. It was 4:17 a.m. Francis was turned away from her, sleeping soundlessly. She closed her eyes, but could think only of the 368 people who, it seemed self-evident now, would rather she'd never been born. She had to get back into the CE chute. She sat up.
"What's the matter?" Francis said.
She turned to find him staring at her.
"Nothing. Just this democracy vote thing."
"You can't worry about that. It's a few hundred people."
He reached for May's back and, attempting to comfort her from the other side of the bed, achieved more of a wiping motion across her waist.
"But who?" May said. "Now I have to walk around campus not knowing who wants me dead."
Francis sat up.
"So why don't you check?"
"Check what?"
"Who frowned at you? Where do you think you are? The 18th century? This is the Circle. You can find out who frowned at you."
"It's transparent?"
Instantly, May felt silly even asking.
"You want me to look?"
Francis said, and in seconds he was on his tablet, scrolling.
"Here's the list. It's public.
That's the whole thing with democracy." His eyes narrowed as he read the list.
"Oh, that one's no surprise."
"What?"
May said, her heart jumping.
"Who?"
"Mr. Portugal."
"Alistair?"
May's head was on fire.
"Fucker," Francis said. "Whatever, fuck him. You want the whole list?"
Francis turned the tablet to her, but before she knew what she was doing, she was backing away, her eyes clenched. She stood in the corner of the room, covering her face with her arms.
"Whoa," Francis said. "It's not some rabid animal. They're just names on a list."
"Stop,"
May said.
"Most of these people probably didn't even mean it, and some of these people I know actually like you."
"Stop, stop."
"Okay, okay. You want me to clear the screen?"
please?
Francis complied. May went into the bathroom and closed the door.
May?
Francis was on the other side. She turned on the shower and took off her clothes.
Can I come in?
Under the pounding water, May felt calmer. She reached the wall and turned on the light. She smiled, thinking her reaction to the list was foolish. Of course the votes were public. With actual democracy, a purer kind of democracy, people would be unafraid to cast their votes and, more importantly, unafraid to be held accountable for those votes. It was up to her now to know who those who frowned at her were and to win them over. Maybe not immediately. She needed time before she'd be ready, but she would know. She needed to know. It was her responsibility to know. And once she knew, the work to correct the 368 would be simple and honest. She was nodding and smiled, realizing she was alone in the shower, nodding. But she couldn't help it. The elegance of it all, the ideological purity of the circle, of real transparency, gave her peace, a warming feeling of logic and order. The group was a gorgeous rainbow coalition of youth, dreadlocks and freckles, eyes of blue and green and brown. They were all sitting forward, their faces alight. Each had 4 minutes to present his or her idea to the Circle Brain Trust, including Bailey and Stenton, who were in the room talking intently to other members of the Gang of 40, and Ty, who was appearing via video feed. He sat somewhere else in a blank white room, wearing his oversized hoodie and staring, not bored and not visibly interested, into the camera and into the room. And it was he, as much or more than any other wise men or senior circlers, that the presenters wanted to impress. They were his children, in some sense, all of them motivated by his success, his youth, his ability to see ideas into execution while remaining himself, perfectly aloof and yet furiously productive. They wanted that too, and they wanted the money they knew went along with the role. This was the assembly Calden had been talking about, where, he was certain, there would be a maximum viewing audience, and where, he insisted, May should tell all her watchers that the circle could not complete, that completion would lead to some kind of Armageddon. She had not heard from him since that conversation in the bathroom, and she was glad for it. Now she was sure, more than ever, that he was some kind of hacker spy, someone from a would-be competitor, trying to turn May and whoever else against the company, to blow it up from within. She shook all thoughts of him from her mind. This forum would be good, she knew. Dozens of circlers had been hired this way. They came to campus as aspirants, presented an idea, and that idea was bought on the spot, and the aspirant was thereafter employed. Jared had been hired this way, May knew, and Gina too. It was one of the more glamorous ways to arrive at the company, to pitch an idea, have it acquired, be rewarded with employment and stock options, and see their idea executed in short order. May explained all of this to her watchers as the room settled. There were about 50 circlers, the wise men, the Gang of 40, and a few assistants in the room, all of them facing a row of aspirants, a few of them still in their teens, each of them sitting, waiting for his or her turn. This will be very exciting, May said to her watchers. As you know, this is the first time we've broadcast an aspirant session. She almost said plankton and was happy to have caught the slur before uttering it. She glanced down at her wrist. There were 2.1 million watchers, though she expected that to climb quickly. The first student, Faisal, looked no more than 20. His skin glowed like lacquered wood, and his proposal was exceedingly simple. Instead of having endless mini-battles over whether or not a given person's spending activity could or could not be tracked, why not make a deal with them? For highly desirable consumers, if they agreed to use Circle money for all their purchases and agreed to make their spending habits and preferences accessible to Circle partners, then the Circle would give them discounts, points, and rebates at the end of each month. It would be like getting frequent flyer miles for using the same credit card. May knew she would personally sign up for such a plan, and assumed that, by extension, so would millions more.
"Very intriguing," Stenton said,
and May would later learn that when he said "very intriguing," he meant that he would purchase that idea and hire its inventor. The second notion came from an African-American woman of about 22. Her name was Belinda, and her idea, she said, would eliminate racial profiling by police and airport security officers. May began nodding. This is what she loved about her generation,
The ability to see the social justice applications to the circle and address them surgically? Belinda brought up a video feed of a busy urban street with a few hundred people visible and walking to and from the camera, unaware they were being watched. Every day, police pull over people for what's known as driving while black or driving while brown, Belinda said evenly. And every day, young African-American men are stopped in the street, thrown against a wall, frisked, stripped of their rights and dignity. And for a moment, May thought of Mercer and wished he could be hearing this. Yes, sometimes some of the applications of the Internet could be a bit crass and commercial, but for every one commercial application, there were three like this, proactive applications that used the power of the technology to improve humanity. Belinda continued. These practices only create more animosity between people of color and the police. See this crowd? It's mostly young men of color, right? A police cruiser goes by an area like this, and they're all suspects, right? Every one of these men might be stopped, searched, disrespected. But it doesn't have to be that way. Now, on screen, amid the crowd, three of the men in the picture were glowing orange and red. They continued to walk, to act normally, but now they were bathed in color, as if a spotlight with colored gels was singling them out. The three men you see in orange and red are repeat offenders. Orange indicates a low-level criminal, a guy convicted of petty thefts, drug possession, nonviolent, and largely victimless crimes. There were two men in the frame who had been colored orange. Walking closer to the camera, though, was an innocuous enough-seeming man of about 50, glowing red from head to toe. The man signaling red, though, has been convicted of violent crimes. This man has been found guilty of armed robbery, attempted rape, repeated assaults. May turned to find Stenton's face rapt, his mouth slightly open. Belinda continued. We're seeing what an officer would see if he were equipped with CU. It's a simple enough system that works through any retinal. He doesn't have to do a thing. He scans any crowd, and he immediately sees all the people with prior convictions. Imagine if you're a cop in New York. Suddenly a city of 8 million becomes infinitely more manageable when you know where to focus your energies. Stenton spoke.
How do they know? Some kind of chip?
Maybe, Belinda said. It could be a chip, if we could get that to happen. Or else, even easier, would be to attach a bracelet. They've been using ankle bracelets for decades now. So you modify it so the bracelet can be read by the retinals and provides the tracking capability. Of course, she said, looking to May with a warm smile. You could also apply Francis's technology and make it a chip, but that would take some legal doing, I expect.
Stenton leaned back. Maybe. Maybe not.
Well, obviously that would be ideal, Belinda said, and it would be permanent. You'd always know who the offenders were, whereas the bracelet is still subject to some tampering and removal, and then there are those who might say it should be removed after a certain period, the violators expunged.
I hate that notion, Stenton said. It's the community's right to know who's committed crimes. It just makes sense. This is how they've been handling sex offenders for decades. You commit sexual offenses, you become part of a registry. Your address becomes public. You have to walk the neighborhood, introduce yourself, all that, because people have a right to know who lives in their midst.
Belinda was nodding. Right, right. Of course. And so, for lack of a better word, you tag the convicts, and from then on, if you're a police officer, instead of driving down the street, shaking down anyone who happens to be black or brown or wearing baggy pants, imagine instead you were using a retinal app that saw career criminals in distinct colors. Yellow for low-level offenders, orange for nonviolent but slightly more dangerous offenders, and red for the truly violent.
Now Stenton was leaning forward. Take it a step further. Intelligence agencies can instantly create a web of all of a suspect's contacts, co-conspirators. It takes seconds. I wonder if there could be variations on the color scheme to take into account those who might be known associates of a criminal, even if they haven't personally been arrested or convicted yet. As you know, a lot of mob bosses are never convicted of anything.
Belinda was nodding vigorously. Yes, absolutely, she said.
And in those cases, you'd be using a mobile device to tag that person, given you wouldn't have the benefit of a conviction to ensure the mandatory chip or bracelet.
Right, right, Stanton said. There are possibilities there, though. Good things to think about. I'm intrigued.
Belinda glowed, sat down, feigned nonchalance by smiling at Gareth, the next aspirant, who stood up, nervous and blinking. He was a tall man with cantaloupe-colored hair, and now that he had the room's attention, he grinned shyly, crookedly.
Well, for better or worse, my idea was similar to Belinda's. Once we realized we were working on similar notions, we collaborated a bit. The main commonality is that we're both interested in safety. My plan, I think, would eliminate crime block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood.
He stood before the screen and revealed a rendering of a small neighborhood of 4 blocks, 25 houses. Bright green lines denoted the buildings, allowing viewers to see inside. It reminded May of heat-reading visual displays.
It's based on a neighborhood watch model, where groups of neighbors look out for each other and report any anomalous behavior. With Neighbor Watch, that's my name for this, though it could be changed, of course, we leverage the power of Sea Change specifically and the Circle generally to make the committing of a crime, any crime, extremely difficult in a fully participating neighborhood.
He pushed a button, and now the houses were full of figures, 2 or 3 or 4 in each building, all of them colored blue. They moved around in their digital kitchens, bedrooms, and backyards.
Okay, as you can see, here are the residents of the neighborhood, all going about their business. They're rendered blue here because they've all registered with NeighborWatch, and their prints, retinas, phones, and even body profile have been memorized by the system.
This is the view any resident can see? Stanton asked.
Exactly. This is their home display.
Impressive, Stanton said.
I'm already intrigued.
So, as you can see, all is well in the neighborhood. Everyone who's there is supposed to be there. But now we see what happens when an unknown person arrives.
A figure, colored red, appeared and walked up to the door of one of the houses. Gareth turned to the audience and raised his eyebrows.
The system doesn't know this man, so he's red. Any new person entering the neighborhood would automatically trigger the computer. All the neighbors would receive a notice on their home and mobile devices that a visitor was in the neighborhood. Usually it's no big deal. Someone's friend or uncle is dropping by, but either way, you can see there's a new person and where he is.
Stanton was sitting back, as if he knew the rest of the story, but wanted to help it speed along.
I'm assuming, then, there's a way to neutralize him?
Yes. The people he's visiting can send a message to the system saying he's with them, IDing him, vouching for him. That's Uncle George. Or they could do that ahead of time, so then he's tagged blue again.
Now Uncle George, the figure on the screen, went from red to blue and entered the house.
So all is well in the neighborhood again.
Unless there's a real intruder, Stanton prodded.
Right. On the rare occasion when it's truly someone with ill intent.
Now the screen featured a red figure stalking outside the house, peering in the windows.
Well, then, the whole neighborhood would know it. They'd know where he was and could either stay away, call the police, confront him, whatever it is they want to do.
Very good. Very nice, Stanton said. Gareth beamed.
Thank you. And Belinda made me think that, you know, any ex-cons living in the neighborhood would register as red or orange in any display, or some other color, where you'd know they were residents of the neighborhood, but you'd also know they were convicts or whatever.
Stanton nodded. It's your right to know.
Absolutely, Gareth said. Seems like this solves one of the problems of Sea Change, Stanton said, which is that even when there are cameras everywhere, not everyone can watch everything. If a crime is committed at 3 a.m., who's watching camera 982, right?
Right, Gareth said. See, this way the cameras are just part of it. The color tagging tells you who's anomalous, so you only have to pay attention to that particular anomaly. Of course, the catch is whether or not this violates any privacy laws.
Well, I don't think that's a problem, Stanton said. You have a right to know who lives on your street. What's the difference between this and simply introducing yourself to everyone on the street? This is just a more advanced and thorough version of good fences make good neighbors.
I would imagine this would eliminate pretty much all crime committed by strangers to any given community.
May glanced at her bracelet. She couldn't count them all, but hundreds of watchers were insisting on Belinda's and Garrett's products now. They asked where, when, how much.
Now Bailey's voice popped through. The one unanswered question, though, is what if the crime is committed by someone inside the neighborhood, inside the house?
Belinda and Garrett looked to a well-dressed woman with very short black hair and stylish glasses.
I guess that's my cue.
She stood and straightened her black skirt.
My name is Finnegan, and my issue was violence against children in the home. I myself was a victim of domestic violence when I was young, she said, taking a second to let that register.
And this crime, among all others, seems like the most difficult thing to prevent, given the perpetrators are ostensibly part of the family, right? But then I realized that all the necessary tools already exist. First, most people already have one or another monitor that can track when their anger rises to a dangerous level. Now, if we couple that tool with standard motion sensors, then we can know immediately when something bad is happening or is about to happen. Let me give you an example. Here's a motion sensor installed in the kitchen. These are often used in factories and even restaurant kitchens to sense whether the chef or worker is completing a given task in a standard way. I understand the Circle uses these to ensure regularity in many departments.
We do indeed, Bailey said, provoking some distant laughter from the room where he was sitting. Stanton explained, We own the patent for that particular technology. Did you know that?
Finnegan's face flushed, and she seemed to be deciding whether or not to lie. Could she say she did know?
I was not aware of that, she said, but I'm very glad to know that now.
Stanton seemed impressed with her composure.
As you know, she continued, in workplaces, any irregularity of movement or in the order of operations and the computer either reminds you of what you might have forgotten or it logs the mistake for management. So I thought, why not use the same motion sensor technology in the home, especially high-risk homes, to record any behavior outside the norm?
Like a smoke detector for humans, Stanton said.
Right. A smoke detector will go off if it senses even the slightest increase in carbon dioxide. So this is the same idea. I've installed a sensor here in this room, actually, and want to show you how it sees.
On the screen behind her, a figure appeared, the size and shape of Finnegan, though featureless, a blue shadow version of herself, mirroring her movements.
Okay, this is me. Now watch my motions. If I walk around, then the sensors see that as within the norm.
Behind her, her form remained blue.
If I cut some tomatoes,
Finnegan said, miming the cutting of imaginary tomatoes,
same thing. It's normal.
The figure behind her, her blue shadow, mimicked her.
But now see what happens if I do something violent.
Finnegan raised her arms quickly and brought them down in front of her, as if hitting a child beneath her. Immediately, on screen, her figure turned orange, and a loud alarm went off. The alarm was a rapid rhythmic screeching. It was, May realized, far too loud for a demonstration. She looked to Stanton, whose eyes were round and white.
"Turn it off,"
he said, barely controlling his rage.
Finnegan hadn't heard him and was going about her presentation as if this were part of it, an acceptable part of it. "That's the alarm, of course, and—"
"Turn it off!"
Stanton yelled, and this time Finnegan heard. She flailed on her tablet, looking for the right button. Stanton was looking at the ceiling.
"Where is that sound coming from? How is it so loud?"
The screeching continued. Half the room was holding their ears.
"Turn it off, or we walk out of here,"
Stanton said, standing, his mouth small and furious. Finally, Finnegan found the right button, and the alarm went silent.
"That was a mistake," Stanton said. "You don't punish the people you're pitching. Do you understand that?"
Finnegan's eyes were wild, vibrating, filling with tears.
"Yes, I do."
"You could have simply said an alarm goes off. No need to have the alarm go off. That's my business lesson for today."
"Thank you, sir,"
she said, her knuckles white and entwined in front of her.
"Should I go on?"
"I don't know,"
Stanton said, still furious.
Go ahead, Finnegan, Bailey said. Just make it quick.
Okay,
she said, her voice shaking.
The essence is that the sensors would be installed in every room and would be programmed to know what was within the normal boundaries and what was anomalous. Something anomalous happens, the alarm goes off, and ideally the alarm alone stops or slows whatever's happening in the room. Meanwhile, the authorities have been notified. You could hook it up so neighbors would be alerted too, given they'd be the closest and most likely to be able to step in immediately and help.
Okay, I get it, Stenton said. Let's move on. Stenton meant move on to the next presenter, but Finnegan, showing admirable resolve, continued.
Of course, if you combine all these technologies, you're able to quickly ensure behavioral norms in any context. Think of prisons and schools. I mean, I went to a high school with 4,000 students, and only 20 kids were troublemakers. I could imagine if teachers were wearing retinals and could see the red-coated students from a mile away. I mean, that would eliminate most trouble. And then the sensors would pinpoint any antisocial behavior.
Now Stenton was leaning back in his chair, his thumbs in his belt loops. He'd relaxed again. It occurs to me that so much crime and trouble is committed because we have too much to track, right? Too many places, too many people. If we can concentrate more on isolating the outliers and being able to better tag them and follow them, then we save endless amounts of time and distraction.
Exactly, sir, Finnegan said.
Stenton softened, and looking down at his tablet, seemed to be seeing what May was seeing on her wrist. Finnegan and her program were immensely popular. The dominant messages were coming from victims of various crimes, women and children who had been abused in their homes, saying the obvious. If only this had been around 10 years ago, 15 years ago, at least, they all said in one way or another, this kind of thing will never happen again.
When May returned to her desk, there was a note, on paper, from Annie.
Can you see me? Just text now when you can, and I'll meet you in the bathroom.
10 minutes later, May was sitting in her usual stall and heard Annie enter the one next door. May was relieved that Annie had reached out to her, thrilled at having her so close again. May could right all wrongs now, and was determined to do so.
Are we alone? Annie asked. Audio's off for 3 minutes. What's wrong?
Nothing. It's just this past perfect thing. They're starting to dole out the results to me, and it's already pretty disturbing, and tomorrow it goes public, and I'm assuming it'll get even worse.
Wait, what did they find? I thought they were starting in the Middle Ages or something.
They are, but even then, it's like both sides of my family are these black-hearted people. I mean, I didn't even know the British had Irish slaves. Did you?
No, I don't think so.
You mean white Irish slaves?
Thousands of them. My ancestors were the ringleaders or something. They raided Ireland, brought back slaves, sold them all over the world. It's so fucked up.
Annie, I mean, I know they're sure about this because it's cross-referenced a few thousand ways, but do I look like a descendant of slave owners?
Annie, give yourself a break. Something that happened 600 years ago has nothing to do with you. Everyone's bloodline has rough patches, I'm sure. You can't take it personally.
Sure, but at the very least, it's embarrassing, right? It means that it's part of me, at least to everyone I know. To the next people I see, this'll be part of me. They'll be seeing me and talking to me, but this'll be part of me, too. It's mapped this new layer onto me, and I don't feel like that's fair. It's like if I knew your dad was a former Klansman.
You're completely overthinking it. No one, I mean no one, will look at you funny because some ancient ancestor of yours had slaves from Ireland. I mean, it's so insane and so distant that no one will possibly connect you to it. You know how people are. No one can remember anything like that anyway. And to hold you responsible? No chance.
And they killed a bunch of these slaves, too. There's some story about a rebellion and that some relative of mine led some mass slaughter of 1,000 men and women and children. It's so sick. I just...
Annie, you've got to calm down. First of all, our time's up. Audio's going back up in a second. Secondly, you just cannot worry about this. These people were practically cavemen. Everyone's caveman ancestors were assholes.
Annie laughed, a loud snort.
Promise me you won't worry?
Sure.
Annie, don't worry about this. Promise me.
Okay.
You promise?
I promise. I'll try not to.
Okay. Time.
When the news of Annie's ancestors went out the next day, May felt at least partially vindicated. There were some unproductive comments out there, sure, but for the most part, the reaction was a collective shrug. No one cared much about how this connected to Annie, but there was new and possibly useful attention brought to the long-forgotten moment in history when the British went to Ireland and left with human currency. Annie seemed to be taking it all in stride, her zings were positive, and she recorded a brief announcement for her video feed, talking about the surprise in finding out this unfortunate role some distant part of her bloodline played in this grim historical moment. But then she tried to add some perspective and levity to it, and to ensure that this revelation wouldn't dissuade others from exploring their personal history through Past Perfect. "Everyone's ancestors were assholes," she said, and May, watching the feed on her bracelet, laughed. But Mercer, true to form, was not laughing. May hadn't heard from him in over a month, but then, in Friday's mail, the only day the post office still operated, was a letter. She didn't want to read it, because she knew it would be ornery, and accusatory, and judgmental. But he'd already written a letter like that, hadn't he? She opened it, guessing that he couldn't possibly be worse than he'd been before. She was wrong. This time, he couldn't even bring himself to type the "dear" before her name. "May, I know I said I wouldn't write again, but now that Annie's on the verge of ruin, I hope that gives you some pause. Please tell her she should cease her participation in that experiment, which, I assure you, and her, will end badly. We are not meant to know everything, May. Did you ever think that perhaps our minds are delicately calibrated between the known and the unknown? That our souls need the mysteries of night and the clarity of day? You people are creating a world of ever-present daylight, and I think it will burn us all alive. There will be no time to reflect, to sleep, to cool. Did it occur to you, circle people, ever, that we can only contain so much? Look at us. We're tiny. Our heads are tiny, the size of melons. You want these heads of ours to contain everything the world has ever seen? It will not work." May's wrist was popping. "Why do you bother, May? I'm already bored." "You're only feeding Sasquatch. Don't feed Sasquatch." Her heart was already thumping, and she knew she shouldn't read the rest, but she couldn't stop. "I happened to be at my parents' house when you did your little idea meeting with the digital brown shirts. They insisted on watching it. They're so proud of you, despite how horrifying that session was. Even so, I'm glad I watched that spectacle, just as I'm glad I watched Triumph of the Will. It gave me the last nudge I needed to take the step I'd been planning anyway. I'm moving north, to the densest and most uninteresting forest I can find. I know that your cameras are mapping out these areas as they have mapped the Amazon, Antarctica, the Sahara, etc., but at least I'll have a head start. And when the cameras come, I'll keep going north. May, I have to admit that you and yours have won. It's pretty much over, and now I know that. But before that pitch session, I held out some hope that the madness was limited to your own company, to the brainwashed thousands who work for you or the millions who worship around the golden calf that is the circle. I held out hope that there were those who would rise up against you people, or that a new generation would see all this as ludicrous, oppressive, utterly out of control." May checked her wrist. There were already 4 new Mercer-hating clubs online. Someone offered to erase his bank account. "Just say the word," the message read. "But now I know that even if someone were to strike you down, if the circle ended tomorrow, something worse would probably take its place. There are 1,000 more wise men out there, people with ever more radical ideas about the criminality of privacy. Every time I think it can't get worse, I see some 19-year-old whose ideas make the circle seem like some ACL utopia. And you people, and I know now that you people, or most people, are impossible to scare. No amount of surveillance causes the least concern or provokes any resistance. It's one thing to want to measure yourself, May, you and your bracelets. I can accept you and yours tracking your own movements, recording everything you do, collecting data on yourself in the interest of, well, whatever it is you're trying to do. But it's not enough, is it? You don't want just your data. You need mine. You're not complete without it. It's a sickness. So I'm gone. By the time you read this, I'll be off the grid. And I expect that others will join me. In fact, I know others will join me. We'll be living underground, and in the desert, in the woods. We'll be like refugees, or hermits, some unfortunate but necessary combination of the two. Because this is what we are.
I expect this is some second great schism where two humanities will live, apart but parallel. There will be those who live under the surveillance dome you're helping to create, and those who live, or try to live, apart from it. I'm scared to death for us all. Mercer.
She'd read the note on camera, and she knew that her viewers were finding it as bizarre and hilarious as she had. The comments were popping, and there were some good ones. Now the Sasquatch will return to his natural habitat, and good riddance, Bigfoot. But May was so entertained by it that she sought out Francis, who, by the time they saw each other, had already seen the note transcribed and posted onto a half-dozen subsites. One watcher in Missoula had already read it while wearing a powdered wig, the background filled with faux patriotic music. That video had been seen 3 million times. May laughed, watching it twice herself, but found she felt for Mercer. He was stubborn, but he was not stupid. He was not beyond hope. He was not beyond convincing. The next day, Annie left her another paper note, and again they planned to meet in their adjoining stalls. May only hoped that since the second round of major revelations, Annie had found a way to contextualize it. May saw the tip of Annie's shoe under the next stall. She turned off her audio. Annie's voice was rough.
You heard it got worse, right?
I did hear something. Have you been crying? Annie,
May, I don't think I can handle this. I mean, it was one thing to know about the ancestors and Jolly Old, but there was a part of me that was thinking, you know, that's fine. My people came to North America, started anew, put all that in the past, but shit, May, knowing that there were slave owners here, too, I mean, that is fucking stupid. What kind of people am I from? It has to be some disease in me, too.
Annie, you can't think about this.
Of course I can. I can't think of anything else.
Okay, fine. But first, calm down. And second, you can't take it personally. You have to separate yourself from it. You have to see it a bit more abstractly.
And I've been getting all this crazy hate mail. I got 6 messages this morning from people calling me Massa Annie. Half the people of color I hired over the years are now suspicious of me, like I'm some genetically pure intergenerational slave owner. Now I can't handle having Vicky work for me. I'm letting her go tomorrow.
Annie, you know how crazy this all sounds? I mean, besides, are you sure your ancestors here had black slaves? The slaves weren't Irish here, too?
Annie sighed loudly.
No, no. My people went from owning Irish people to owning African people. How's that? Couldn't keep my people from owning people. You also saw that they fought for the Confederate side in the Civil War?
I saw that, but there's millions of people whose ancestors fought for the South. The country was at war, half and half.
Not my half. I mean, do you know the chaos this is wreaking on my family?
But they never took all this family heritage stuff seriously, did they?
Not when they assumed we were blue bloods, May. Not when they thought we were Mayflower people with this unimpeachable lineage. Now they take it really fucking seriously. My mom hasn't left the house in 2 days. I don't want to know what they find next.
What they found next, 2 days later, was far worse. May didn't know, ahead of time, precisely what it was, but she did know that Annie knew, and that Annie had sent a very strange zing out into the world. It said,
"Actually, I don't know if we should know everything." When they met in the stalls, May couldn't believe Annie's fingers had actually typed that sentence. The circle couldn't delete it, of course, but someone, May hoped it was Annie, had amended it to say, "We shouldn't know everything. Without the proper storage ready, you don't want to lose it."
"Of course I sent it," Annie said. "The first one, anyway."
May had held out hope that it was some terrible glitch.
"How could you have sent that?"
"It's what I believe, May. You have no idea."
"I know I don't. What idea do you have? You know what kind of shit you're in? How can you, of all people, espouse an idea like that? You're the poster child for open access to the past, and now you're saying... What are you saying, anyway?"
"Oh, fuck, I don't know. I just know I'm done. I need to shut it down."
"Shut what down?"
"Past perfect. Anything like it."
"You know you can't. I'm planning to try." "You must already be in deep shit."
"I am, but the wise men owe me this one favor. I can't handle this. I mean, they've already, quote-unquote, relieved me of some of my duties. Whatever, I don't even care. But if they don't shut it down, I'll go into some kind of coma. I already feel like I can barely stand or breathe."
They sat in silence for a moment. May wondered if she shouldn't leave. Annie was losing her hold on something very central about herself. She felt volatile, capable of rash and irrevocable acts. Talking to her at all was a risk. Now she heard Annie gasping.
Annie, breathe.
I just told you I can't. I haven't slept in 2 days.
So what happened? May asked.
Oh, fuck. Everything. Nothing. They found some weird stuff with my parents. I mean, a lot of weird stuff.
When does it go live?
Tomorrow.
Okay, maybe it's not as bad as you think.
It's so much worse than you can imagine.
Tell me, I bet it's fine.
It's not fine, May. It's anything but fine. The first thing is that I found out my dad and mom had some kind of open marriage or something. I haven't even asked them about it. But there are photos and video of them with all kinds of other people. I mean, like, serial adultery on both sides. Is that fine?
How do you know it was an affair? I mean, if they were just walking next to someone, then it was the 80s, right?
More like the 90s. And trust me, it's definitive.
Like sex photos?
No, but kissy photos. I mean, there's one with my dad with his hand around some woman's waist, his other hand on her tit. I mean, sick shit. Other pictures with mom and some bearded guy. A series of naked photos. Apparently the guy died, had this stash of photos. They were bought at some garage sale and scanned and put in the cloud. Then when they did the global facial wreck, ta-da! Mom's naked with some biker guy. I mean, the two of them just standing there sometimes naked, like posing for prom.
I'm sorry.
And who took the pictures? There's some third guy in the room? Who was that? A helpful neighbor?
Have you asked them about it?
No, but that's the better part of it. I was about to confront them when this other thing popped up. It's so much worse that I don't even care about the affairs. I mean, the pictures were nothing compared to the video they found.
What about the video?
Okay. This was one of the rare times the two of them were actually together, at night at least. This was from some video taken at some pier. There was a security camera there because I guess they store stuff in the warehouses there on the water. So there's a tape of my parents hanging around this pier at night.
Like a sex tape?
No, it's much worse. Oh, fuck, it's so bad. May, it's fucking so twisted. You know my parents do this thing every so often. They sort of have a couple's night where they go on some bender. They've told me about it. They get stoned, drunk, go dancing, stay out all night. It's on their anniversary every year. Sometimes it's in the city, sometimes they go somewhere like Mexico. It's like some all-night thing to keep them young, keep their marriage fresh, whatever. Okay? So, I know this happened on their anniversary. I was 6 years old.
So?
It's one thing if I hadn't been born. Oh, shit. So, anyway, I don't know what they were doing beforehand, but they show up on this surveillance camera around 1 a.m. They're drinking a bottle of wine and kind of dangling their feet over the water. And it all seems pretty innocent and boring for a while, but then this man comes into the frame. He's like some kind of homeless guy, stumbling around. And my parents look at him and watch him wandering around and stuff. It looks like he says something to them, and they sort of laugh and go back to their wine. Then nothing happens for a while, and the homeless guy's out of the frame. Then, about 10 minutes later, he's back in the frame, and then he falls off the pier and into the water.
May took in a quick breath. She knew it was making this worse.
Did your parents see him fall?
Now Annie was sobbing.
That's the problem. They totally did. It happened about 3 feet from where they were sitting. On the tape, you see them get up, sort of lean over, yelling down into the water. You can tell they're freaking out. Then they sort of look around to see if there's a phone or anything.
And was there?
I don't know. It doesn't look like it. They never really left the frame. That's what's so fucked up. They see this guy drop into the water, and they just stay there. They don't run to get help or call the police or anything. They don't jump in to save the guy. After a few minutes of freaking out, they just sit down again, and my mom puts her head on my dad's shoulder, and the two of them stay there for another 10 minutes or something. And then they get up and leave.
Maybe they were in shock.
May, they just got up and left. They never called 911 or anything. There's no record of it. They never reported it. But the body was found the next day. The guy wasn't even homeless. He was maybe a little mentally disabled, but he lived with his parents and worked at a deli, washing dishes. My parents just watched him drown.
Now Annie was choking on her tears. Have you told them about this?
No. I can't talk to them. They're really disgusting to me right now.
But it hasn't been released yet? Annie looked at the time.
It will be soon. Less than 12 hours.
And Bailey said?
He can't do anything. You know him.
Maybe there's something I can do, May said,
having no idea what. Annie gave no sign she believed May capable of slowing or stopping the storm coming her way.
"It's so sick. Oh, shit,"
Annie said, as if the realization had just passed through her.
"Now I don't have parents."
When their time was up, Annie returned to her office where, she said, she planned to lie down indefinitely, and May returned to her old pod. She needed to think. She stood in the doorway where she'd seen Calden watch her, and she watched the CE newbies taking comfort in their honest work, their nodding heads. Their murmurs of assent and disapproval gave her a sense of order and rightness. The occasional circler looked up to smile at her, to wave chastely at the camera, at her audience, before returning to the work at hand. May felt a surging pride in them, in the circle, in attracting pure souls like this. They were open. They were truthful. They did not hide or hoard or obfuscate. There was a newbie close to her, a man of no more than 22, with wild hair rising from his head like smoke, working with such concentration that he hadn't noticed May standing behind him. His fingers were typing furiously, fluidly, almost silently, as he simultaneously answered customer queries and survey questions.
"No-no? Smile? Frown?" he said, nodding with a quick and effortless pace. "Yes, yes. No. Cancun. Deep sea diving. Upscale resort. Breakaway weekend. January. January. Meh. 3, 2. Smile. Smile. Meh. Yes. Prada. Converse. No. Frown. Frown. Smile. Paris."
Watching him, the solution to Annie's problem seemed obvious. She needed support. Annie needed to know she wasn't alone. And then it all clicked. Of course, the solution was built into the circle itself. There were millions of people out there who no doubt would stand behind Annie and would show their support in myriad unexpected and heartfelt ways. Suffering is only suffering if it's done in silence, in solitude. Pain, experienced in public, in view of loving millions, was no longer pain. It was communion. May turned from the doorway and made her way to the roof deck. She had a duty here, not only to Annie, her friend, but to her watchers. And being witness to the honesty and openness of the newbies, of this young man with his wild hair, made her feel hypocritical. As she climbed the stairs, she assessed her options and herself. Moments ago, she'd purposely obfuscated. She'd been the opposite of open, the opposite of honest. She'd hidden audio from the world, which was tantamount to lying to the world, to the millions who assumed she was being straightforward always, transparent always. She looked out over the campus. Her watchers wondered what she was looking at. Why the silence?
"I want you all to see what I see," she said.
Annie wanted to hide, to suffer alone, to cover up. And May wanted to honor this, to be loyal. But could loyalty to one trump loyalty to millions? Wasn't it this kind of thinking, favoring the personal and temporary gain over the greater good, that made possible any number of historical horrors? Again, the solution seemed in front of her, all around her. May needed to help Annie and repurify her own practice of transparency, and both could be done with one brave act. She checked the time. She had 2 hours until her soul search presentation. She stepped onto the roof deck, organizing her thoughts into some lucid statement. Soon, she made her way to the bathroom, to the scene of the crime, as it were, and by the time she'd arrived and saw herself in the mirror, she knew what she needed to say. She took a breath.
"Hello, watchers. I have an announcement to make, and it's a painful one, but I think it's the right thing to do. Just an hour ago, as many of you know, I entered this bathroom, ostensibly under the auspices of doing my business in the second stall you see over here." She turned to the row of stalls. "But when I entered, I sat down, and with the audio off, I had a private conversation with a friend of mine, Annie Allerton."
Already a few hundred messages were shooting through her wrist, the most favored one thus far already forgiving her.
"May, bathroom talk is allowed. Don't worry, we believe in you. To those sending your good words to me, I want to thank you," May said. "But more important than my own admission is what Annie and I talked about. You see, many of you know that Annie's been part of an experiment here, a program to trace one's ancestry as far back as technology will allow, and she's found some unfortunate things in the deep recesses of her history. Some of her ancestors committed serious misdeeds, and it's got her sick about it all. Worse, tomorrow, another unfortunate episode will be revealed, this one more recent and perhaps more painful.
May glanced at her bracelet, seeing that the active viewers had nearly doubled in the last minute to 3,202,984. She knew that many people kept her feed on their screens as they worked, but were rarely actively watching. Now it was clear her impending announcement had the focused attention of millions. And, she thought, she needed the compassion of these millions to cushion tomorrow's fall. Annie deserved it.
So, my friends, I think we need to harness the power of the circle. We need to harness the compassion out there of all the people out there who already know and love Annie, or who can empathize with Annie. I hope you can all send her your good wishes, your own stories of finding out about some dark spots in your family past, and make Annie feel less alone. Tell her you're on her side. Tell her you like her just the same, and that some distant ancestor's crimes have no bearing on her. Don't change the way you think about Annie.
May finished by providing Annie's email address, Zing feed, and profile page. The reaction was immediate. Annie's followers increased from 88,198 to 243,087, and, as May's announcement was passed around, would likely pass a million by the end of the day. The messages poured in, the most popular being one that said, "The past is past, and Annie is Annie." It didn't make perfect sense, but May appreciated the sentiment. Another message gaining traction said, "Not to rain on the parade, but I think there is evil in DNA, and I would worry about Annie. Annie needs to try doubly hard to prove to someone like myself, an African-American whose ancestors were enslaved, that she's on the path of justice." That comment had 98,201 smiles and almost as many frowns, 80,198. But overall, as May scrolled through the messages, there was, as always when people were asked for their feelings, love, and there was understanding, and there was a desire to let the past be the past. As May followed the reaction, she watched the clock, knowing she was only an hour away from her presentation, her first in the Enlightenment's great room. She felt ready, though, with this Annie business emboldening her, making her feel, more than ever, that she had legions at her back. She also knew that the technology itself and the Circle community would determine the success of the demonstration. As she prepared, she watched her bracelet for any sign of Annie. She had expected some reaction by now, certainly something like gratitude, given that Annie was no doubt inundated by, buried under, an avalanche of goodwill. But there was nothing. She sent Annie a series of zings, but heard no reply. She checked Annie's whereabouts and found her, a pulsing red dot, in her office. May thought briefly about visiting her, but decided against it. She had to focus, and perhaps it was better to let Annie take it all in alone. Certainly by the afternoon she would have taken in and synthesized the warmth of the millions who cared for her, and would be ready to properly thank May, to tell her how, now with the new perspective, she could put the crimes of her relatives in context, and could move forward into the solvable future and not backward into the chaos of an unfixable past.
"You did a very brave thing today," Bailey said. "It was brave, and it was correct."
They were backstage in the great room. May was dressed in a black skirt and a red silk blouse, both new. A stylist orbited around her, applying powder to May's nose and forehead, Vaseline to her lips. She was a few minutes away from her first major presentation.
"Normally, I would want to talk about why you'd chosen to obfuscate in the first place," he said. "But your honesty was real, and I know you've already learned any lesson I could give you. We're very happy to have you here, May."
"Thank you, Eamon."
"Are you ready?"
"I think so."
"Well, make us proud out there."
As she stepped onto the stage, into the bright single spotlight, May felt confident that she could. Before she could get to the Lucite podium, though, the applause was sudden and thunderous and almost knocked her off her feet. She made her way to her appointed spot, but the thunder only got louder. The audience stood, first the front rows, then everyone.
It took May great effort to quell their noise and allow her to speak.
"Hello, everyone. I'm May Holland," she said.
And the applause started again. She had to laugh, and when she did, the room got louder. The love felt real and overwhelming. Openness is all, she thought. Truth was its own reward. That might make a good tile, she thought, and pictured it laser-cut in stone. This was too good, she thought, all of this. She looked out to the circlers, letting them clap, feeling a new strength surge through her. It was strength amassed through giving. She gave all to them, gave them unmitigated truth, complete transparency, and they gave her their trust, their title, love.
"Okay, okay,"
she said, finally raising her hands, urging the audience into their seats.
"Today, we're going to demonstrate the ultimate search tool. You've heard about soul search, maybe a rumor here and there, and now we're putting it to the test, in front of the entire circle audience here and globally. Do you feel ready?"
The crowd cheered its answer.
"What you're about to see is completely spontaneous and unrehearsed. Even I don't know who we'll be searching for today. He or she will be chosen at random from a database of known fugitives worldwide."
On screen, a giant digital globe spun.
"As you know, much of what we do here at the Circle is using social media to create a safer and saner world. This has already been achieved in myriad ways, of course. Our weapon sensor program, for example, recently went live and registers the entry of any gun into any building, provoking an alarm that alerts all residents and the local police. That's been beta tested in two neighborhoods in Cleveland for the last 5 weeks, and there's been a 57% drop in gun crimes. Not bad, right?"
May paused for applause, feeling very comfortable, and knowing what she was about to present would change the world. Immediately and permanently. "Fine job so far," said the voice in her ear. It was Stenton. He'd let her know he would be additional guidance today. Soul search was a particular interest of his, and he wanted to be present to guide its introduction. May took a breath.
"But one of the strangest facets of our world is how fugitives from justice can hide in a world as interconnected as ours. It took us 10 years to find Osama bin Laden. D.B. Cooper, the infamous thief who leapt from an airplane with a suitcase of money, remains on the lam, decades after his escape. But this kind of thing should end now. And I believe it will now."
A silhouette appeared behind her. It was the shape of a human, torso and up, with the familiar mugshot measurements in the background.
"In seconds, the computer will select, at random, a fugitive from justice. I don't know who it will be. No one does. Whoever it is, though, he's been proven a menace to our global community, and our assertion is that whoever he or she is, Soul Search will locate him, or her, within 20 minutes. Ready?"
Murmurs filled the room, followed by scattered applause.
"Good," May said. "Let's select that fugitive."
Pixel by pixel, the silhouette slowly became an actual and specific person, and when the selection was finished, a face had emerged, and May was shocked to find it was a woman, a hard-looking face squinting into a police camera. Something about this woman, her small eyes and straight mouth, brought to mind the photography of Dorothea Lange, those sun-scarred faces of the Dust Bowl. But as the profile data appeared beneath this photo, May realized the woman was British and very much alive. She scanned the information on screen and focused the audience on the essentials.
"Okay. This is Fiona Highbridge, 44 years old, born in Manchester, England. She was convicted of triple murder in 2002. She locked her 3 children in a closet and went to Spain for a month. They all starved. They were all under 5. She was sent to prison in England, but escaped with the help of a guard who she apparently seduced. It's been a decade since anyone's seen her, and police have all but given up on finding her. But I believe we can, now that we have the tools and the participation of the Circle."
"Good," Stenton said into May's ear. "Let's focus now on the UK.
As you all know, yesterday we alerted all 3 billion Circle users that today we'd have a world-changing announcement. So we currently have this many people watching the live feed.
May turned back to the screen and watched a counter tick up to 1,109,001,887.
Okay, over 1 billion people are watching. And now, let's see how many we have in the UK.
A second counter spun and landed on 14,028,981.
All right. The information we have says that her passport was revoked years ago, so Fiona is probably still in the UK. Do you all think 14 million Brits and 1 billion global participants can find Fiona Highbridge in 20 minutes?
The audience roared, but May didn't, in fact, know if it would work. She wouldn't have been surprised, actually, if it didn't, or if it took 30 minutes, an hour. But then again, there was always something unexpected, something miraculous about the outcomes when the full power of the circle's users was brought to bear. She was sure it would be done by the end of lunch.
Okay, everyone ready? Let's bring up the clock.
A giant 6-digit timer appeared in the corner of the screen, indicating hours, minutes, and seconds.
Let me show you some of the groups we have working together on this. Let's see the University of East Anglia.
A feed showing many hundreds of students in a large auditorium appeared. They cheered.
Let's see the city of Leeds.
Now a shot of a public square, full of people bundled up in what appeared to be cold and blustery weather.
We have dozens of groups all over the country who will be banding together, in addition to the power of the network as a whole. Everyone ready?
The Manchester crowd raised their hands and cheered, and the students of East Anglia did too.
Good. May said. Now on your mark, get set, go!
May drew her hand down next to the photo of Fiona Highbridge. A series of columns showed the comment feed, the highest ranked, appearing at the top. The most popular thus far was from a man named Simon Hensley from Brighton.
Are we sure we want to find this hag? She looks like the Scarecrow from Wizard of Oz.
There were laughs throughout the auditorium.
Okay, time to get serious, May said.
Another column featured users' own photos, posted according to relevance. Within 3 minutes, there were 201 photos posted, most of them close corollaries to the face of Fiona Highbridge. On screen, votes were tallying, indicating which of the photos were most likely her. In 4 minutes, it was down to 5 prime candidates. One was in Bend, Oregon, another was in Banff, Canada, another in Glasgow. Then something magical happened, something only possible when the full circle was working toward a single goal. 2 of the photos, the crowd realized, were taken in the same town, Carmarthen, in Wales. Both looked like the same woman, and both looked exactly like Fiona Highbridge. In another 90 seconds, someone identified this woman. She was known as Fatima Helensky, which the crowd voted was a promising indicator. Would someone trying to disappear change their name completely, or would they feel safer with the same initials, with a name like this, different enough to throw off any casual pursuers, but allowing her to use a slight variation on her old signature? 79 watchers lived in or near Carmarthen, and 3 of them posted messages claiming they saw her more or less daily. This was promising enough, but then, in a comment that quickly shot to the top, with hundreds of thousands of votes, a woman, Gretchen Karopchik, posting from her mobile phone, said she worked with the woman in the photo at a commercial laundry outside Swansea. The crowd urged Gretchen to find her there and then and capture her by photo or video. Immediately, Gretchen turned on the video function on her phone and, though there were still millions of people investigating other leads, most viewers were convinced Gretchen had the